to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people whose houses resemble the biggest eBay job lot of CDs and DVDs that you will ever see in your life. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me, as ever, is Sian Pattenden, the imposing and statuesque Cher to my runtish sonny. Hello, Sian, how are you doing?
If only. I'm not that statuesque, am I? I'm a bit your height. We're shorties, aren't we?
Yeah, we are indeed. Have you had an exciting week?
I've had a very exciting week, thank you.
I believe you've been sending out your live drawings of Eurovision for charity in the post.
And the live drawing sending out takes longer than the live drawing in the great irony of things. But this is really good. We raised almost three times as much as normal for Great Ormond Street on the night. So I'm really, really pleased. It worked really, really well. So hurrah.
Who was the hardest contestant to draw?
It's towards the end of the evening.
Were you losing your mojo?
I'm losing my mind at this point. When you're into kind of drawing number 22... And some of them are indeed quite challenging in the pop sphere, and they're all in spandex, and there's always flames, and you've just drawn flames, and you wonder. Usually, I start drawing them upside down and sideways, and or just their head, yeah. or just discombobulated bodies.
Well, we can talk about your future as a court artist at another time, which all sounds terribly exciting, but we should probably crack on with the show and meet some of the guests. He is the co-founder of Weirdo Music Site The Quietus. His first book, Out of the Woods, is out in January, and it's a meditation on sex, death, and what we mean by nature. And he's a regular contributor to The Guardian, Q, NME, Mojo, Vice, and Dazed and Confused. He's also a very dapper exponent of 1940s utility chic. And if this was television, you'd be very impressed indeed by his lovely Polish watch. It's Luke Turner. Hello, Luke. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Jolly good. In the quietest lately, you're one of the few people who genuinely liked that Arctic Monkeys album.
I did, yeah.
Why did everybody hate it then?
I don't know. There's no accounting for tastes. I've never been a fan, really. I mean, I kind of thought they were all right as indie laddie rock bands go. They'd always tried to do something a bit different, but I was greatly amused by all the pictures coming out from the sort of run-up to this record, where they look like these sort of, I sort of wrote, they look like recently divorced Basingstoke solicitors who kind of hang out playing poker and having cigars.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's so embarrassing. Then the album came out. It's like, actually, that really works.
I really like it.
I think it's
record.
A fantastic record. But there is a bizarre, the divide seems to be the old school fans hate it, and lots of people who you wouldn't expect to like it, possibly like The Quietus and Pitchfork and other people, are really into it. So, I'm really pleased that they pushed the boat out on it. It's great.
Well, people said there's no tunes on it, and that's why I like it, because there's no tunes on it.
That's some good tunes.
Texture.
Oh, texture.
Sian, who else is joining us on this show?
Well, funny you should mention that. She's a veteran of the glory days of Smash Hits, turned writer and broadcaster for Radio 4 and others. Her book, Out of Time, looks at the process of middle age when you've grown up in a culture that tells you you'll always be young, not like us at all. Among the people she's interviewed this month are Sir Anthony Tony Hopkins and Manchester DJ Dave Haslam. It's the very famous Miranda Sawyer. Hello, Miranda.
Hello. I must say, look, I'm really interested in your book, because it sounds quite similar to mine. Sex
out
and
of,
death and
out,
nature.
It's out of the something.
Amazing. These are more books which we want.
His happens in a copse.
Mine happens
with a copse nearby.
Yes.
Tony Hopkins, that interview, he seemed like an absolute chap.
Oh, he was amazing. So basically, you know, Sir Anthony was in...
Do you have to call him Sir? Are you allowed Tony?
No, he really wants to call you to call him Tony.
Fine.
So you go... Basically, he was in Rome filming a film about the Pope. I mean, it's just really weird. So basically, there is a film coming out, hey, pop fans, on Netflix, which is about the last two popes, so the present pope and the one before, who was the one that everyone thought was horrible, Ratzinger, and he's playing Ratzinger, and Jonathan Pryce is playing the groovy Francis, right? So he's there filming this film, and I have to go and interview him for The Guardian about King Lear, which he was just out the other day. And so I pop over there thinking, well, you know, it'll be okay. I think he's great, but it'll probably be a bit of a rubbish interview. Anyway, I just think I hit him when he was a bit bored and lonely. We really got on. And every time I was going, ooh, probably time's up, and the PR's coming in, he's going, no, ask me some more. This is great. This is really brilliant. The photographer started setting up. He was going, carry on. It was just absolutely brilliant.
And did he show you his horseshoe? He carries a horseshoe around all the time. It's quite heavy, I think.
Yes, he has a horseshoe in Lear, which he uses as a crown. He had it in his suitcase, not on him. Sorry, but it wasn't.
I want to see it one day. I want to see him get through customs with it as well. See how that
He's
goes.
He's Tony Hopkins. He will get anywhere.
Wonderful. Andrew, what else have we got on the show today?
Well, I'm glad you asked me, Sian. This week, yes, there's another Star Wars movie out, so they seem to come around like buses now. But is the story of Han Solo's youth worth telling? And do Northerners say Han while Southerners say Han? We're going to be looking at Solo, plus Paris in the Spring, a compilation by Saint Etienne's Pete Wiggs and Bob Stanley, of French music written and recorded during Les Evenements de 1945. 1968. I can't say Swastle and Wheatart yet. Willett encourages us to tear up paving stones, declare society a bourgeois illusion, and smoke our heads off in free love communes. Let's hope so. Plus, we're going to be having a look at Sky Arts' new documentary, Generation Grime, which is what it says on the tin, and The Break with Michelle Wolfe, the new Netflix series starring the comedian who committed the awful crime of offending President Trump and his entourage at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner. All these things after this important message.
The generosity of Big Mouth listeners is heartwarming. If you regularly tune into the show, you'll know we've been asking for a small contribution of a fiver a month, a notional, symbolic, entirely totemic, imaginary pint of beer, all via the crowdfunding platform Patreon to cover our bills and keep the show going. We're over halfway there to get to our target of £600 a month, after which we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. So if you enjoy the sort of informed, educational and very particular pop talk that only Big Mouth can do, go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link is also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
OK, let's go into space. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, Star Wars movies were very few and far between. There was a sense of event and occasion. Now they seem to come along every 5 minutes, and you know you're getting old when the stormtroopers start to look younger and prettier. Solo is another prequel for the Star Wars saga, this time telling us how Han Solo gets to be the intergalactic hotshot we know and love, and how his bromance with Chewbacca got started. Alden Ehrenreich plays the Harrison Ford role. Donald Glover, a.k.a. Childish Gambino, is Lando Calrissian, and Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones plays The Dame, because all crime stories need The Dame. Are we talking Empire Strikes Back or Phantom Menace or somewhere in between? Let's have a taster.
I was kicked out of the Flight Academy for having a mind of my own. I'm going to be a pilot. Best in the galaxy.
Hey, kid, I'm putting together a crew. You in?
That's yes.
A bit of Solo there. Miranda Sawyer, set this up for us. What is happening and why is it happening?
It's all happening before. There we go. What we learn about Han Solo, I'm going to say Han, sorry, Northern, Han Solo, is that he comes from a horrible place, a bit like a kind of Fagin's yard.
Yes.
So he has to go out when he's young, this is, and rob people and get scrap stuff and then give it to a really horrible creature, and she bullies everybody. And he runs away with his gorgeous girlfriend and... through various kind of trickery and slightly boring car chase, he gets to the border and he gets through and she doesn't. We then follow him and he is motivated. His motivation is to get back to his galaxy and save his girl. But it all goes. I don't want to kind of give too much away, but that is his motivation.
Did you enjoy it? What did you make of it overall?
Okay, when it started off, I was really disappointed, I have to say. I was like, oh my God, this is really dragging. There's far too much kind of, you know, there's a kind of lot of stuff in trenches, a bit like World War II. But then Woody Harrelson turns up. Mm-hmm. And when Woody Harrelson turns up, it all gets a lot more jolly for me. I'm aware that I am speaking as a 51-year-old woman. I was watching it with a 12-year-old and he was, you know, less excited when Woody Harrelson turned up. And then, of course, Donald Glover turned up and we literally punched the air when he turned up. Mm. And it gets better. It gets better when they go into space. So there is a bit where they're in space, and once they're in space doing their thing, that's when it kind of, you know, in inverted commas, lifts off. But before that, I did find it a little dull.
Han Solo is by some measure, proper grown-up Han Solo, is by some measure the most charismatic character in the entire Star Wars saga. Did this fit the bill? Did this measure up to Harrison Ford's Han Solo?
Okay, so this is my problem. So obviously I was just missing Harrison Ford all the way through. But I have to say that my 12-year-old was going, but no, he was really cool. He was really funny. He had, you know, I mean, he is played, you can see... The Han Solo that I know in the character when he is young, he's full of bravado. He gets him wrong. He's a bit of a, you know, he's quite macho and a bit silly. But personally, because I really liked Han Solo, he was really the only one I liked, obviously, other than the R2-D2. it failed for me. But I do think, you know, if you are not as old as me, that it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, my son was completely enraptured by him. He thought he was great.
Luke. Luke, search your feelings. Did you enjoy this film?
I enjoyed it a lot more than I was expecting to. I mean, I must admit, I have been to see all of the various ones that keep coming out, and I was into them when I was a kid, obviously, because I was born in 1978. But I thought that the one thing that was strange with it was, though he does a very good fist of Harrison Ford playing Han Solo, there were certain elements where you go, it kind of undermined his character in the original film, because you're like, well, you've already gone through this. Why is it all such a surprise to you, you know, in that way? I actually thought the bit in the trenches was great. The sort of World War One, whatever, drama was quite exciting.
Yeah.
And I thought it got way better towards the end. And the beginning was quite exciting.
But my problem with it was that I actually don't think he pulls off the truth about the Harrison, about the Han Solo character, because when we meet Han Solo in Star Wars, he's the kind of more worldly guy that Luke Skywalker would sort of want to be.
Yeah.
He's kind of the cool older brother who sort of, you know, cuts corners and is a total rascal. And I'm willing to watch a movie where someone turns into that person, but I didn't see it here.
No.
I did not see in Alden Ehrenreich any ghost of that, like, of the smart guy who will, like, pull the blaster under the table.
Well, I suppose they're trying to represent him as a kind of teenage version of that, aren't they? Mm. And they're also trying to represent Woody Harrison's Beckett as the person that he then becomes, because Woody Harrison was the Harrison Ford character, essentially, wasn't he? Although he was a bit bad. But essentially, it's a bit like that's the father figure that Han Solo has that he then becomes in Star Wars. That's what I kind of took it as.
My surprise, really, was that he's actually really naive, and street smarts are not something that you learn when you're 23.
That was
really ingrained in you. You know, the Artful Dodger isn't an ingenue until he meets Fagin. He's already on that road.
Well, that's what I thought didn't quite add up, because at the beginning it's all, I've been stealing things since I was six or whatever, and then he is incredibly naive, and he's far too nice. He doesn't really do a huge amount of... You think the ruthlessness would already be there if you've gone through what is childhood and then kind of, you know, being in the Imperial forces for a bit. You're going to be a lot tougher than he actually was, which was a bit hapless at times.
Do you think this is because it's a Ron Howard film? And Ron Howard, you know, I mean, it's a bit like a kind of Steven Spielberg. We're not allowed to like people unless they have, you know, we are literally told at one point that he is the good guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are not allowed to like him if he is.
Well, it's Disney, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. This is another huge problem I have with it, is it's the kind of movie where people tell you who they are and tell you what events mean rather than showing you them. We have an absurd situation where Han Solo and Kira, played by Emilia Clarke, have just stolen the thing that's going to get them out of this awful camel led in space shipyard where they live. And instead of exulting, they explain to each other what it is. This is the thing that we can use to bribe our way off planet. Yes, we can. We need never live in this awful shipyard ever again. I'm going to buy a spaceship. What are you going to do? I don't know. Might get my hair done. It's all, but you know, this is the universe of Basil Exposition, and I know it's for kids. That's fine.
I am also slightly sick of American films using Native Americans and black people to tell us what is good, I have to say. But that does really get on my nerves. Whenever you kind of, you know, if somebody takes off their helmet and is revealed to be a kind of, you know, Native American or you know, dressed in some kind of ethnic tribal look.
A non-middle class white person.
They are the good guys, and it's okay, but it's really bad tokenism. It just drives me mad.
Be fair, though. Lando does not spend any time telling you how to be a good guy. He is the sharp cynic and the sharp kind of self-serving gambler. I think his Lando is much more successful than young Han Solo. He's charismatic. He's got a self-deprecating sense of humour.
He's got some kind of verve as well. Like, as soon as he arrives, you kind of think the film just lifts as soon as he arrives. Well, it's so much better.
I think they could have made more about the, you know, everybody knew from Star Wars that he'd won the Millennium Falcon. Han had won the Millennium Falcon in a car game or whatever, and the car those bits are quite short and there's no tension in them, and I really wish there'd been a longer
You want a bit more bondage,
a little bit
you?
More kind of exactly, and some wily eyes and things like that.
I'd love to see you go into the meeting at Disney and say, hi, I'm Luke and I'm producing the new Star Wars movie. We're going to cut down on the space battles, we're going to have longer card game sequences, you know, for the kids.
But I have to say
just a little bit longer, and some of the, you know, they do these silly things now in these Star Wars films where they have huge great sequences that don't really do anything.
Yep.
That's important.
And honestly, it's, you know, my son who's 12 literally said, "I am bored of all the action sequences."
Wow.
So I mean, that is quite, you know, something.
Yeah.
You know, he's a fanatic. You know, he goes to see Marvel, he goes to see DC. But he said that first car chase was rubbish.
Well, you mentioned it's a Ron Howard film, and this movie has had a very troubled genesis. The Hollywood Reporter wrote that the original director is Lord and Miller, who did 21 Jump Street and the Lego Movie. have a comedic sensibility and improvisational style, while Lawrence Kasdan, who famously wrote Empire Strikes Back, and he wrote this one, favours a strict adherence to the written word. What is on the page is what must be shot. People need to understand that Han Solo is not a comedic personality. He's sarcastic and selfish. Well, not here he isn't. He's neither comedic nor sarcastic and selfish. And I saw this movie and thought, actually, this needs more Lego movie. This needs more slapstick between Han Solo and Chewbacca.
With a wink, doesn't it?
Yeah, because he's... The great thing about Han Solo in Star Wars is he thinks he's it, and he's always screwing up. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. You know, when the warp drive fails, that's the key to his charisma, that it's flawed. And to me, this was kind of quite a two-dimensional version of one of the great kind of pulp action figures of modern cinema. To me, this is kind of, I mean, I kept seeing it in contrast with Rogue One, the other kind of standalone prequel, which I think for my money is certainly the best of the new Star Wars movie, and maybe the best Star Wars movie, because everything in it proceeds from character. You meet a bunch of characters, you know they're all gonna die, and you're thoroughly invested in them. Whereas this is like, with a couple of exceptions, you're pretty sure everybody's going to survive. And the truly interesting character relationship of Han Solo and Chewbacca is barely explored.
Oh, yes, we've got to mention Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was actually very good.
Yeah.
He was acting people off the screen.
Some good rug acting. I just kept thinking about all the other Han Solos you could have made. You know, the 14-year-old Han Solo, Artful Dodger, or just a straight-up Han and Chewbacca bromance, you know, the great buddy movie.
Road movie.
Movie in space. You know, and another thing I thought was lacking was, where is the joy of speed, the joy of driving? I mean, there's a theory that Baby Driver is basically a backdoor Han Solo origin movie, and it actually works much better, Baby Driver.
Yeah. The action sequence, sorry to bang on about this, there's a weird one which is basically it's kind of train heist, and that of... to me was obviously referencing Indiana Jones, and I kind of thought, well, that's a bit odd, because I don't want to be thinking about Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, when I'm watching a Star Wars film.
I really like that bit on the big screen. It was pretty exhilarating to watch.
Yeah.
In terms of the action, you know, just a simple action sequence, because they keep doing this thing in Star Wars films. I did it in the Last Jedi as well, where they just like fly spaceships into the ground and they kind of bounce along and don't just disintegrate. And I wish they'd stop doing that. I mean, because obviously the rest of Star Wars is completely plausible. Bouncing spaceships
really
along the ground really just irritates
me. It's a Barnes Wallace approach to the Millennium Falcon, skipping it along the snow. Well, it's a mixed opinions there, but never mind. There'll be another Star Wars along in a minute, won't there?
Okay, let's have a bit of music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune, and it's going to be a grime-heavy show this week. Miranda Sawyer, what have you brought in for the listeners and why?
Okay, I have brought in Hangman by Dave, or Santan Dave, and the reason why I brought it is because we watched Generation Grime for Big Mouth, which I've very much enjoyed, and we will be deconstructing. And I kind of wanted, the end of that documentary, it talks about how grime is absolutely for everybody now. It's not just for, as they say, people in the hood. It's not just for people who've kind of grown up around it. It's for everyone. And Dave made this, has made this album, which you could kind of almost play anywhere. It has the kind of noises behind it are quite often a bit like church music. It's produced by the same person who produced Stormzy's album. His lyrics are just great. And the reason why I chose Hangman as opposed to Greetings to the New Prime Minister, which is the one that everyone knows, is just a couple of sequences towards the end, which I just think amazing.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Hangman by Dave.
The guy I'm dodging is the tax man. They say that fame is a game, and it's true, because if you say the wrong word, then everybody wants to hang, man. Our surge about the times that I had, man. I brought the fam together like when Tommy got the black hand. And if you got a good girl, you need to keep her close and let her in, because the difference is when things hit the fan, they're going to disappear. All them side chicks and all the mistresses, all your broskies and your affiliates, and all the man that you were standing in the pictures with.
Hangman by Dave, as chosen by hardcore hood rat Miranda Sawyer there. At the top of the show, we mentioned Paris in the Spring, a new compilation of music that was in the air during the political convulsions in France in the late 1960s, 68 in particular. Exactly 50 years later, Bob Stanley and Pete Wiggs from out of St Etienne capture this febrile atmosphere in a new album for Ace Records, where Serge Gainsbourg is both the touchstone and probably the only person you've heard of, unless you've also heard of Jane Birkin and Françoise Hardy. This is French pop going dark and très cool as well. We'll be talking about it after this track, Jane Birkin with Encore Louis. Louis.
Jane Birkin with Encore Lui from Paris in the Spring, a selection of music to occupy the Sorbonne by, put together by Pete and Bob from Saint Etienne. Sean, you're basically the Valerie Solanas de nos jours. Give us the grounding on 1968 and the musical background to this record.
I will try. I've brought in my copy of Leaving the 20th Century, Situationist Text, incomplete. 1968, May, were the main student riots in Paris and beyond. But what was interesting about them is that people were getting sick of capitalism and American imperialism. It wasn't just like student loans or anything. It was just the whole philosophy of capitalism they were sick of. And what's interesting is it also spread to the workers. So from student sit-ins and riots, spread all through France. And at one point, 11 million people were striking. In 1968, 22% of the population, that's not even the working population, that's the whole population. It was run by Charles de Gaulle, the government at the time, and he popped off. He was a bit frightened, popped off for a few days and then came back to try and deal with it. So what we have here is a compilation of music from around that time that takes the chanson Yeah Yeah Pop, which is very squeaky and plasticky, and says, look, this was new dark pop and we're going to show it to you now.
Well, my politics lectures were always banging on about Les Evenements du 68, and this is enormously atmospheric. Stinks of Gauloise and aggressive aftershave, and so do the fellas as well. Luke, what did you make of this?
I quite liked it. I think it's one of those interesting things where it's a music of a time that doesn't sound like Febrile Revolution to me. It sounds like a this beautiful, sophisticated pop music that you'd associate to, you know, I can imagine Pete and Bob in sort of nice modernist houses putting on their records on an expensive sound system and sitting back for a gin while listening to it. You know, and I find that that's the interesting aspect to it. It's from music from a febrile time, you know, because thinking about grime, which is just so aggressively of its place, or, you know, the way reggae just sounds like the music of insurrection. This doesn't at all to me. And maybe that part of that's a linguistic thing where you can't quite hear what's going on.
But also it's the feeling, it's the texture. I mean, to me, it sounds like, this sounds like the components for a dozen unmade DJ Shadow albums. You know, it's all of that kind of, that beautiful sort of, you know, string glissandos and great sort of disaffection and detachment. There's a track called Helicopter by Mireille Darc, which she sounds bored. It's really breathy. It's like ennui, the album.
But it's still quite a lot of love songs, I have to say. I mean, you know, some of them, you know, some of them are better than others, but there's one called... basically, Unfortunately, You Died. And it says, I would have invited you, I would have talked to you, I would have taken tea with you. It isn't like, Unfortunately, You Died, you know, up the revolution. Oh. It was, if only you were here, we could be as one. And there's quite a lot of kind of love songs on there. So, and the very last one, which I was really enjoying, which is a Romy Schneider one, which is really, really beautiful. And it's also rendered slightly creepy with that way that French chansons quite often do, by putting a creepy bloke on it. Mm. And that always slightly unnerves me.
There was a lot of creepy blokes around at that time.
It's the leitmotif of revolutionary France, and it's a creepy bloke. Well, Miranda, perhaps the object of the song, Perhaps You Died, isn't a woman. Perhaps it is the ideal of revolutionary freedom that has died, Miranda.
She is talking about quite a genteel life. She's literally saying, I could have been taking tea with you. I could have been doing this with you. So perhaps that's true, but, you know, maybe I'm just reading it incredibly on the surface, but on the surface, that is what she is saying.
I'm saying it's the death of bourgeois bourgeois.
Yeah, that you will no longer take tea. Yeah, we'll throw it out of the window.
Nah, I've got to set fire to your house and we've got to smoke cigarettes instead.
It doesn't sound, I mean, I think, you know, I think Luke is right. It doesn't sound revolutionary, does it? It sounds absolutely gorgeous, but it doesn't sound revolutionary. Yeah.
And if you play the whole thing and it's a double LP as such, it does sort of drift off in the background. Apart from, I was listening to it again this morning, there's a song called Balliere, which there's bits of it that sound like The Orb. And I thought, oh, here I'm listening to sort of some sort of different musical structure and they're having a go and that's a bit revolutionary. Yeah. But the rest of it is very much verse, chorus, isn't it?
I think that's what I loved about it, because I actually really, really did like this record an awful lot. It's the idea that to float off into your own mind world is revolutionary. And it made me think, I was mentally comparing it with the Anglophone British and American music of 67 to 68, and you know, terrible trite crass things like Revolution by the Beatles, which is so obvious and Route One and dull. This is so much more compelling to me because it is about unzipping the back of your head and floating off into the world of
I think it's something like unzipping the back of someone's dress. That was my
that
sort of thigh rub.
The creepy blokes elements has always put me off French pop, I have to say. But it is definitely worth a listen. There's some beautiful tracks.
But there's
on
Francois
it.
Hardy. There's Jane Birkin. There's some other women that I haven't got on my list.
There's some Serge Gainsbourg, and you don't hear him. It's just an instrumental. But
This dirty old bloke is an occupational hazard of listening to French pop
pre
about 1990. However, you can hear it. In this, you can hear Air, you can hear Super Discount, you can hear a bit of stuff. You can all the, you know, the, you know, that's, I don't know if anybody ever saw that advert for a Clarkson book, where there was a big quote from the Clarkson book and it said, French pop music as attractive as an inside-out horse. Mm. And this album shows up the stupidity of that idea of French music ever more clearly.
I also think this is, as you're trying to say, also a bit subtly political.
Yeah.
Bob Stanley, Pete Wiggs are pretty anti-Brexit, as far as I know, and I know their feelings on the matter. This is saying, come on, this is European, we're just going to bring out lots of albums with European stuff, show this, that this is revolutionary, this is what they did, come on everyone, get together and galvanise in a sophisticated way. And I think that is also the message behind the record, they would happily say.
Yeah, and there's some beautiful sleeve notes, I have to say, as ever, of course, you know, Bob Sunny, ex, you know, world's best sleeve note writer, but you know, those, the, I mean, it is really beautiful to have that in context as well.
They are in a really good position, aren't they, because it's like, there are few people who've got the breadth and knowledge, but also the kind of pop sensibilities to be able to put together records like this. This is better than a playlist. It is an actual record. It is designed to be listened to as a record rather than just something that you stick on at random. Are we coming to the end of the world where there are insane undiscovered scenes to be discovered, do you think?
That's definitely quieter territory.
No, I think there are always going to be more, you know, and particularly because we look so much still towards America, which I find in eternally frustrating, whereas, you know, there's the entire rest of the planet to discover. And that's, again, we're kind of jumping a bit forward onto the grime thing. That's one of the things that was really great with their opening it out and being like, yeah, there's grime all over the world. That's exciting. And it's great to have a British musical export, not an American one that everyone's obsessed with. So I think there's going to be tons of scenes all over the shop. It's really the kind of crate digging aspect. You need people like Pete and Bob, or, you know, Analog Tapes from Africa, these kind of real heads who can go into places and obviously do it properly, make sure people are paid and all of that. But there's loads to still be discovered, and I think that's really positive.
Well, we're going to be, certainly I'm going to be playing this Paris in the Spring record over the summer at my Situationist barbecues, where we barbecue the bourgeoisie. Anyway, if you like Big Mouth, you might also be interested in another podcast that we're putting together with the high-end Danish loudspeaker manufacturer Dali. The show is called Be There with Dali. It ties in with a new print magazine from Dali, which is also called Be There. And it's all about the studio talents and the hidden geniuses behind the truly great recordings. Dali stands for Danish Audiophile Loudspeaker Industries, and I can vouch that the quality and accuracy of the sound will blow your mind, because it certainly blew mine. The first episode of Be There with Dali is up now, and you can find it at audioboom.com/channels/be-there, or just search Be There with Dali in the Apple Podcast Store, and we're going to put it on the Big Mouth Facebook and Twitter feeds too. Here's a little excerpt of the first episode for you. Here's our guest, Andrew Mail from Mojo Magazine, discussing the albums that changed studio recording forever.
The thing that's important about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because that's the album we're talking about, is the freeing up of the Beatles. The fact that, you know, 3 months earlier, they'd played their final live concert. So they kind of came to Abbey Road Studios with a sense of freedom. And also they'd been freed in other ways, shall we say, by their use of LSD. And so their ears and their eyes had been open to a different way of looking at and hearing the world. Sgt. Pepper had originally begun as an autobiographical album. So like the tracks Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever were originally meant to be on it. And it was meant to be an album about their childhoods. And so they were drawing on that, and they were drawing on music from the past, like, you know, Liverpool brass bands and kind of a sense of, you know, music from the 1920s. But at the same time, they were competitive beasts. So they were trying to sort of best the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. And so they just basically threw everything at it. I mean, you've got an album where there's a paper and comb on it, but there's also a 41-piece orchestra. You know, you've got tracks that are being slowed down, sped up, reversed, double-tracked. But, you know, nothing was off limits. And also they were lucky to have a producer in George Martin who'd had a history of working on comedy records. So his established mode of practice was someone coming in and going, George, let's try this, see if it's funny, see if it works, see what it sounds like.
There's actually quite a lot of the goons in the Beatles, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Sort of major blood knock stomach and all that kind of
very
thing. Funny noises.
Very much so,
Trevor Horn calls sonic events.
Yeah, there's lots of sonic events. But also you've got to factor in that ruthlessness, and you've also got to factor in that kind of eclectic nature of the Beatles. I mean, there'll be people who say, oh, well, such and such a band did it first, or such and such an artist did it first. But it's very like Orson Welles. If you look at Citizen Kane, you can cite all the directors who did those things first, but Orson Welles brought them all together in the perfect form. Sergeant Pepper was the, you know, the Orson Welles of 60s music.
A little taste of our new podcast, Be There With Dali, for you there. Get it in the Apple Podcast Store. Now, comedy. It's been the new rock and roll since about 1993, and unlike the old rock and roll, comedy retains the power to stick two fingers up to the man. Such was the case when US comedian Michelle Wolfe appeared at the 2018 White House Correspondents' Dinner. Daily Show veteran Wolfe opened a brilliant full clip on Donald Trump and his acolytes, and instead of standing by her, the Washington Press Corps shamefully and meekly said she wasn't appropriate, but then they might. Now, Wolfe has her own series on Netflix, and we're going to talk about it after this clip. I'm on a mission, bringing my dreams to
fruition. I ain't playing at all. She's one woman tough enough for the boys' club.
For a deal this risky, you don't seem nervous.
I never sweat. I win.
Sorry, did I wake you?
I don't sleep. I win.
Red wine in a white suit? You got guts.
I don't spill. I win.
You're feisty, but how do we know if you're feisty enough?
You see my fiery red hair? It's a reflection of my fiery personality.
A clip from the break with Michelle Wolfe there. Miranda Sawyer, did you see the battle with the Trumposphere, and what did you make of all that hoo-ha first off?
I did, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, in terms of just watching comedy, gags per second, it was absolutely on the money. It was completely great, and I urge anyone who hasn't seen it to immediately go and look it up. And the press correspondents were wimpy, to kind of call her out about it. She was great. I actually saw her before. I went to see Chris Rock when he toured, and she was one of the support acts. And I have to say, you know, it's in a massive arena when you go and see those things. We saw it at Wembley. He did O2. And it's quite a hard thing to get that comedy across. And when she first started talking, I had exactly the same reaction that she picks up on in the show, which is, oh my God, her voice is terrible. Her voice is awful. And we found it really hard to listen to, but we did stay. But honestly, her voice is quite grating if you're not used to it.
She's like the woke Joe Pascali.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible. But I have to say, about this show, the television show, there's loads of things I really liked about it. The initial thing that you notice is how she is dressed. She's a woman on American television in a pair of skinny jeans and a T-shirt and trainers. This never happens. That doesn't happen. You have to be dolled up to the max to have any form of show. And so the initial impression is like, I was quite shocked. I was like, is this actually being broadcast?
Is this a proper show?
Yes, it's a proper show. Like, what is it? And she is immensely funny. She's like, it's the same thing. She's writing it on, it's not on the hoof, but it goes out once a week.
Yeah.
So it's very contemporaneous, and it is written and then brought straight out. There's kind of different elements to the show. So there's a kind of straightforward what you expect. Here I am hosting a show. These are the gags. And then you go to adverts, and they're not adverts. They're kind of skits, and they are really funny. The thing that I thought was most interesting is when towards the end she brought in another comedian who's a female comedian, and they sat down, and you think it's a kind of unscripted conversation, then you gradually realise, oh no, this is scripted too. And I thought it was pretty good, I have to say. I thought she was really funny.
Luke, what did you make of it?
I didn't laugh once.
I thought
it was awful. And I really liked the President's Dinner speech. That was fantastic. But this, the voice is hard work. I think it's the thing with American comedy a lot of the time, you know, particularly with a live audience, they whoop and cheer at kind of crude bits,
basic
jokes. It's like, this is just really not clever. I thought the stuff, the cum joke was rubbish. The stuff about not wanting a baby at the end was, my friend, female friends do that better in the pub. I just, the whole thing made me cringe. The Alexa advert, it was like, you know, it's not as good as Vic and Bob's pretend adverts. I just found the whole thing... I mean, I don't like that. It's that American humour. I really don't. I've never liked The Daily Show, for instance. I know she worked on that. I just really struggled with it, I'm afraid.
See, I really do like The Daily Show, and I think she is really good on it, because she has this strange role, and often female comedians have this on The Daily Show, of being the person who comes on and horrifies the host. We had it with Jon Stewart. We got it with Trevor Noah now. And, you know, Kristen Schaal used to do it with Jon Stewart, would come on and say the unsayable, and Jon Stewart would blanch. And now Michelle Wolfe does it with Trevor Noah. And her stuff on The Daily Show is so sharp and so... It's as good as the White House Dinner stuff. And I felt this really fell short, because partly it's overstretched. Secondly, she's kind of got this burden of carrying the thing. She is both the host and the comedian, so there's nothing to bounce off. And I've got to say, you know, her voice. Okay, it is a feature, not a bug. She's supposed to sound annoying. I can deal with it over a 3.5 minute Daily Show sketch. Over 27 minutes, it was genuinely blackboard, you know, fingernails on the blackboard.
Do you think it would be better than if it was a slightly different format, if it was the sketch show or just kind of little 5 minute lengths? Or...
I thought the sketch bit was terrible, though. The strong yeah, role.
I think maybe the problem, yeah. Sometimes the problem with these things is they just, as you said, they just go on too long. So the little skits are kind of good, but they're just going on slightly too long.
Yeah, I think that's the case here. I mean, I actually thought the fake trailer for the fake Netflix show was quite funny. Mm. And, you know, if you lean more heavily on that, where she can play a character and she
that was almost her, my favourite yeah. bit, yeah. actually.
Where she employs her annoyingness.
Yes.
Yeah.
When it really is made up rather than we've scripted it, but let's look like we've scripted it, yeah. which the rest of it seemed like.
What yeah. did you think of the rest of the show?
I found it really hard going, but I feel bad about saying that because I think that in maybe 12 weeks' time, it could be really amazing. It's finding its feet. Yes, the voice is difficult. Yes, I've read so many features. I don't want to be a mum. I don't need to see it on TV again. I don't really care. I thought that it needed to find its feet and some new ground, and then it might be quite good. But that, as Bunny is saying, that very American format. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think as British people, I'm not sure that we're used to that very staid, scripted idea.
Yeah, I think maybe the problem is, you know, if you're hitting the American format, which is the main problem as a British member of the audience is actually we're kind of two steps ahead of the joke, isn't it? So if you're doing something about not wanting babies, for instance, now that's fine, but we've actually kind of moved on from that and gone a bit further. And that's quite often what I feel about American humour, is that it's a bit like American pop. It's got to hit the cheap seat. So you really whack the obvious point right at the back.
But there's also another form of cheap seat that's being hit here, which is this is all comedy that the audience agrees with. You know,
but all comedy's like that.
No, it isn't, because good comedy pokes you and makes you think again about your beliefs. You know, Luke's right to point out that there's a lot of
Miranda doesn't.
Well, but you know, when you get a cheer line because you're basically saying you're sort of offering the corpus of currently agreed progressive woke stuff and getting a cheer line from that. That's kind of slightly ingratiating.
And stuff like when she goes, oh, we can say what we want, but fuck Pepsi. And it's like, oh, well done. You know, it's just not...
EasyTargets.com.
The level of radicalism was extremely low.
It is interesting, actually, if you compare it, because, you know, when we saw the Chris Rock show, the thing that's really amazing about the Chris Rock show is essentially, I mean, there's nothing I can tell you. It's all completely filthy and also... It does what Andrew was saying, is it takes you to a point as a liberal audience where you're going, oh my God, no, don't go there. So he's literally talking about the first half is racism and the second half is breaking up with your wife. And I can tell you nothing about it because it's all awful, but you laugh.
We're having nothing that dismantles the preconceptions, that dismantles the idea of a star vehicle, of someone speaking to camera. It's all completely traditional. It's very conventional. That's a real problem.
And the substance of the comedy was, we all agree on this, don't we? Yeah. We're all good people and we all agree on this, which is, and that's fine. I don't agree with what she's saying, but it doesn't necessarily make it all that funny. You know, American comedy is pretty strong at the moment. You know, you get a lot of exciting stuff. But I really noticed the difference between a 23-minute network show and a 27-minute Netflix show. It felt long. Really long and spread thin.
Well, maybe we should be nice and say what Sian said, which is just early days.
Early days.
And also, I'm very much a believer in at least she's up there having a go.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
In her jeans.
In her jeans and her sparkly trainers.
Okay, let's have a bit more music. Luke Turner, it's your turn. What have you got?
I've got a new song by Chromatics called Black Walls, which is taken from an album that is being waited for a long time called Dear Tommy. The main guy from Chromatics recorded it, didn't like it, smashed up all of the copies. He's called Johnny Jewel. He did a load of stuff with David Lynch, I think, for the Twin Peaks soundtrack. And what I love about Chromatics is it's like hyper-sophisticated pop music that, you know, you feel like you're on a private jet and your life's gone wrong. And I like that kind of pop music. And I just think this song's terrific.
Well, we're all very familiar with that feeling in the world of it, as our private jets are just not quite good enough. This is Chromatics with Black Walls.
She turns white.
That was Chromatics with Black Walls, as chosen by Luke Turner. Which brings us to Generation Grime on Sky Arts, a new documentary covering the rise of the titular musical culture in London. It's even got David Lammy MP in it, although why they didn't call it Grime Scene Investigation is beyond me. What is it like as a watch? Do we learn things? Are we excited by things? We're going to find out after one track from this documentary. This is Skepta, and That's Not Me.
No, that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, no, that's not me. Lips any girl, no, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, no, 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 that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, no, that's not me. Lips any girl, no, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, no, that's not me.
That was That's Not Me by Skepta, with the £80 video that got Grime back on its cheapo track. The arc of Generation Grime is how Grime goes from DIY through expensive, expansive major label stuff and back to cheapo, because cheapo is where it's at. Miranda Sawyer, you're up on the grime, but you are totally up on the grime. What did you make of Generation Grime?
Oh, I just was really happy it's been made. I was just, everything about it I enjoyed. There's a few kind of players that are not interviewed. You know, there's no Skepta, you know, for instance. But there are quite a lot of people who are interviewed who I really admire and are rarely interviewed, including Jamie, who I've badgered for an interview for 10
years. Wiley.
No one ever gets Wiley. And Dizzy was really good. There's a lot of people in there. You know, there's Retro 2. There's loads of people. And the thing I really like about it is it just gives the whole scene the respect it deserves. And, you know, I'm speaking to you. We are all pop writers here. This is what we do. We contextualise music that we love. And all scenes need someone to do that, or they just don't make a difference. You know, they don't go down in history books. You used to need writers to write about, you know, punk or whatever. You know, I come from Manchester. Manchester is entirely mythologised through its music, and that happened because people wrote about it. And I've always felt like, oh God, grime really needs writers. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it doesn't need writers. It just needs people to make decent documentaries about it. And, you know, in this documentary, you know, they reference Channel U, which obviously made a lot of difference when people made their videos and just popped them up there. And it's just, it's really nice to see it given the respect it actually deserves, I think. You know, it's like, you know, when you watch BBC Four on a Friday night and you watch it and you think, okay, but I've watched this a million times before. I don't need to know it anymore. I want to know about
the
new music.
Strike,
please give new music the respect. Give new music the respect that you're giving all this old music. And that's what this documentary does. I was really pleased with it.
I was really impressed by I thought it was not just a great story full of great characters, but I thought that the depth and the kind of resources that went into it, there's a lot here.
Beautifully shot. Really great.
You meet a lot of people and you know who they all are. You're instantly introduced to them. You understand what's going on. And what really struck me was the extent to which this benefits from the fact that this is music that was made in the era of the camera phone.
Yeah.
Like all my favourite scenes from Two Tone when I first got into music, Acid House and all the rest of it, there's no footage because it was literally taking place where people couldn't afford cameras, or maybe cameras didn't even exist. But what you see in Generation Grime, you see amazing things. You see Dizzy when he's about 12.
Yeah, and you see this, battle rhymes. The battle rhymes are so great. Yeah. It's the best part.
You see raves taking place. You see, and the kind of grittiness and the out-of-focus, wobbly camera stuff is entirely part of the grain and the texture of the movie.
Is that a rare music documentary that actually needs wobbly pictures of tower blocks rather than just using them with the same footage of bins on the street? It was 1976. There was Prog and there was the Winter of Discontent.
As a friend of the show, Alexis Petridis, always points out, whenever there's a documentary about Britain in the 60s, it's a bloke taking a guardsman's jacket off a rail in Granny Takes a Trip. That same bit of footage. Because it's the only bit of footage that really exists. Whereas there's a wealth of stuff here. And the great thing is that clearly an awful lot of research and time and effort has been gone into to get this stuff.
Well, I thought one of the things was really interesting that I was looking at the credits, and Kieran Yates was one of the production consultants or something. You know, and she, I was saying, you know, I think Grime has had great writers like Dan Hancock, who's got a new book out. Jeffrey Bjarke, who wrote Grime and Black Masculinity, which is an amazing book, came out last year. And then Kieran was has been a writer on it. And, you know, it's taken a long time for this to happen because it was its own thing. And the narrative arc from underground to the, I mean, some of that stuff that went into the mainstream, they're very honest. It was crap.
It was terrible.
Really terrible. Like Dizzy's with the Holiday song is awful. And I've forgotten how terrible that song is. And I think it is incredible for me, that that movement is like the most underground thing that's happened in British music for years.
Yeah.
And it's now absolutely huge. And, you know, there's all... We get it a lot at the quieters, but boring old men on Twitter going, we need a new punk.
I know.
You
know, all of this.
And
oh my God,
grime is the thing that goes... Your music isn't political anymore. And grime is the thing where you just... That all those boring old men have been shut up.
Yes. Yeah.
Shut up, shut by shut down. You know,
shut away. Yeah, shut down, yeah. Interesting that you mentioned that, because I thought it was great that in the middle of this movie, we see when grime goes crap.
Yeah.
It goes pop, it goes crap. There's terrible choreography, awful videos, bad makeup, looks really naff. In fact, a lot of it looks like the kind of, like a Smack the Pony spoof of what grime would be, you know. And it's honest enough to say we had a really terrible period here and then got it back on track with that video of That's Not Me by Skepta, which, you know, according to the movie, cost £80 to make and is full of rawness and excitement that just is not there in a... In a big record label video.
What's interesting about it as well, because I kept thinking it is, you know, generally to do anything to do with grime is you have to know the people, or you can't get anywhere near. That's what I kind of admire about them, really, is they quite often say, well, you can't come in and swoop down and say, well, I'd like to do an interview with Skepta now, because you don't know anything about it, we're not going to let you do it. And so I was really admiring of the fact they must have had some really brilliant researchers and, you know, to who actually knew the people, who, because everyone is talking quite relaxed, you know, in a relaxed
very
manner,
candid.
Very interesting,
they're
really candid, they're incredibly clever about it. You know, it's a really great documentary.
Sean, what did you make of it?
We do have the elephant in the room being that, is there one woman who's interviewed in it?
Well, that's it. But not really anybody else.
This is a very... And you're talking about the book Grime and Masculinity, if I've got that right. It's a very male movement, and... I really like grime, but I really hope that the next step is a few more birds in it, please.
Well, I mean, because two of the best writers on grime were women, like Chantel Fiddy and Hattie Collins. And maybe you could have done with one of them as a talking head voice.
Hattie Collins actually was the key script consultant.
Oh, was she? So she's in it as well.
In a lot of ways, it's her film. But I think you're right. One small component I thought was missing from this is that this is a music that happened in the raves. It's as much about the fans as the people who make the music. And there wasn't a lot of the fans in there. I wanted a little bit of somebody saying, my life was really shit and boring and I discovered this world, and it's not because I wanted to be an MC or a DJ, because this was my night out. And that's a little bit that's missing. But there's so much richness in it that it's...
I mean, it is like criticising a lovely throne, isn't it?
Yes.
Another thing, I did think that no one really nods to American hip-hop and the way that they could be counter-influenced by that. So saying we wanted something of our own. There's not a lot of talk about Kanye or that
sort
of mega
global thing.
They do
say that this is our thing and we don't need America's approval.
I know, and they obviously did that on purpose, but I still wanted a bit of context to say this other stuff was happening at the same time, and this is glitzy and this is, you know...
Yeah, I suppose, and also in the end, that Kanye and Drake had to kind of come to grime to get any kind of credibility back, really.
Yeah, it's also quite a funny film as well, and really, really charming, I think, in that not only do you get connected with the absolute excitement of, you know, young people discovering something brand new and it working, but then you also see like Koreans and Russians and Poles
Japanese
doing grime.
That was
so great. Good. I love the Japanese. Yeah, yeah.
But that's the thing that's always really struck me about the grime artists is they're just this, and the whole network around them and the business side, they're really sharp entrepreneurs because they've had to be. They've got no other option. But they're all really nice kids. They're very, very... The humour is amazing. That's one of the things I've always... I've always struggled with American hip-hop because I don't like the humour. The humour in grime...
It's just
so good. It's like really funny, and the music sounds like the Radiophonic Workshop you can dance to. It's just amazing. And I think there should be a series about grime mums. The thing that turns up all the time in grime is they didn't have any money. They're always living at their mum's house, and that comes up a lot.
Yes,
and then there's, you know, Stormzy's mum in the video.
That's his mum.
And he always thanks his mum in speeches. And I think there's this really like beautiful thing where they are fam, as they say. But it's beyond that. It's this sort of matriarchal society that's brought them up.
And I love that. There's the interesting fact that, like, you know, this music is presented in the papers as kind of, you know, urban and dangerous, and look at these awful frightening kids, and here's a drill video, and oh, violence. And then you meet the kids through this film, and they are the upstanding young people you'd want to build a country on. You know, they're all conscientious, they're all hardworking, they're smart, they're funny. This is like this is where you should be drawing your MPs from.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally an argument that, you know, some of the idea that veganism is so cool now is because of Jamie, because he is a vegan and so many people follow him on Twitter. And also the Corbyn thing as well. You can kind of relate quite a lot. He's an incredibly influential character.
So it's not all good stuff then. Okay.
Well, no, the people... yeah, no, sorry, son of the butcher. But also the other thing that I...
Corbyn, actually, but never mind.
The other thing that I would... find quite interesting is I think the British pop is always best when it is made by children of immigrants. So if you think about the Beatles, it's kind of children of Irish immigrants, and if you look at Grime, it's the same thing, yeah. Because I think that you need to be a slight outsider to have, you know, really hardworking parents, essentially. Mm-hmm. Parents mm-hmm. who say, you've got to go out and you've got to do something. I'm not having you sitting yeah. around. Mm-hmm. And then you get really amazing pop. But that's all our yeah. best pop nearly always comes out of that way.
There's a lot of Nigerian parentage going on here. Nigerian yeah, parents being absolutely. Notoriously disciplinary.
Yes, and that's Ghanaian as well.
As we're saying, that's the other programme. Can they do that programme about yeah. the context and the second generation stuff? Mm-hmm. I think that'd be amazing.
Yeah. But it is something. We're watching the documentary, like the little medley of tunes at the beginning. They're just so good. I mean, yeah. it's just brilliant, brilliant pop songs. I think yeah. so. Probably my favourite, my favourite British pop music since the sort of Erasure, really.
yeah. Grime, Erasure, it's basically the same thing. So Generation Grime is on Sky Arts, available, streaming or whatever it is on demand right now. Everybody should go and watch it because it's just brilliant. And we're coming towards the end of the show, which means it's closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a pork fat washed mezcal at their local cocktail bar this weekend? Yes, that is a real drink. I looked it up. Ooh. Miranda Sawyer, what's your closing time chatter for the weekend?
Okay, this is generally something that I find problematic. Perhaps you can all help. Shall I share with the group?
Hashtag problematic.
Okay. So, I am very comfortable with the idea that I can like somebody's art and not like that person. That is very an easy thing for me to cope with. However, I think that we're in a kind of live situation at the moment. So, if you look at someone, essentially this is triggered by Roseanne. Mm. So, Roseanne obviously came back with a very successful reboot of her original show and then tweeted absolutely terrible tweets and her show has been cancelled. I slightly struggle with that because if you... I mean, obviously, I don't struggle. You know, she's treated appalling things and she should be berated for that. But I slightly struggle with us completely censoring people who are bad, censoring their art. However, I'm a kind of hypocrite about this. So I don't really want to hear anything to do with Chris Brown. Like, you know, I'm not interested in that and him at all. Mm. But I find it quite, you know, and yet I will read Philip Larkin and I still listen to Michael Jackson. So I find this a very problematic and knotty problem, and I'm hoping the group can help.
It's the Morrissey question, which we've wrestled yeah. with many, many times, the Morrissey question, the Philip Larkin question. You were saying before the show that is the basic determination of this, are they dead?
Yes, exactly. So
dead,
I think if
right.
they're dead, it's okay. We're allowed to say, well, it was of that era, you know, and also they're dead now, so they're not corrupting us anymore. But if they are alive, it seems to be quite hard to judge, you know, like,
also,
are we allowed
like,
to like them whilst they're alive?
So is their art corrupting us at all? Because like Philip yeah. Larkin was a rotter who wrote some of the most humane poetry you could possibly imagine. Chris Brown, less so.
Yes, exactly.
Chris Brown,
yeah.
less so. Although she, you know, her show originally broke down so many barriers.
Yeah, it was great.
People
yeah.
on TV, she's very pro all the good stuff that we like and has now destroyed it, ruined it and put everybody out of a job as well.
Yes.
So it's kind of hard to stand by.
Yes, I agree. I just find it hard. It's that live dead thing I find slightly difficult. you know, because
kill
also,
them and then you can like
yes,
them.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. We could just
put
shoot her
somewhere in between. Yeah. She can go into a special place. And
I tend to find it particularly music I like. There's a lot of wrong-uns and it's packed with wrong-uns. And what annoys me is among the kind of online. Twittery, woke, slightly younger than me people, they can be massively hypocritical in that some people will be persona non grata instantly, whereas others seem to get a free pass. Like Michael Gira from Swans, for instance, was accused of rape in a Facebook post and people just won't go near him anymore. Genesis Peorage, who tried to kill Cozy Fanny Tootie about three times, beat her up, extorted money, terrible human, and that's all in a legally watertight autobiography, and yet Porridge gets a free pass.
You know what's at fault, as usual? Social media.
Yeah.
Yes.
When before it was the instant judgment on the tweet, people would look at the stuff in the round, make a sober judgment. Even, you know, even on Michael Jackson, you'd make a sober, detached judgment. Now it's like, you said the bad thing, into hell you go.
Mm-hmm.
And
not a great
Yes, everybody's cross all the time, aren't they? It's just it's like having a row with somebody, and in, you know, what would normally happen is you'd then walk away, think about it, and think, actually, I was a bit of an idiot as well. Mm. And there's no, it's just like everything happens in the centre of the row. Nobody ever steps away and goes, oh, well, I was a bit of an idiot, and you're a bit of an idiot. It's probably both of our faults. Yeah.
Luke, what's your closing time, chatter?
My closing chatter is a positive one, in that something's changed a lot in the 10 years since we've been doing The Quietest, and I think the kind of the UK mainstream and underground in music and culture has gone further and further apart. Like when I was reading all of your words in the 90s, I suppose, it felt that there was more crossover between music that was far out and the mainstream, and that has always been the case in Britain since Bowie, really. Now, what's happening these days, I think, is that there's just this incredibly fertile underground scene, which we're calling New Weird Britain at The Quietest. And a lot of it is, it's very queer influenced, or is queer in its performance. It's a lot of it is led by women. A lot of it is political. It's sonically radical. A lot of it is trying to re-engage with the British landscape. And it's just this hectic, brilliant music that's now supported by a kind of countercultural scene, like really great communication networks across the country. It's probably more like America was in the 80s. Now, the problem is nobody really buys any of the records anymore, and because the magazines and newspapers are shrinking their coverage so dramatically, it's very hard for it to kind of cross over to wider audiences. But I just wanted to celebrate this positive time.
Hands off a New Weird Britain.
Does it need to cross over?
That's a good question. I've always really loved music that is weird and does cross over, because I genuinely don't believe that anything, you know, stuff is too difficult for people to understand. You know, you listen to what music in parts of Africa, and particularly, say, Egypt with Electro Charby, it sounds hectic. It's just like really fast keyboards and auto-tune. It's like the most avant-garde music going, but it's played at weddings and everyone's grannies are dancing to it. So I don't think that people can't listen to this stuff. And it frustrates me sometimes that things can't reach a bigger audience just for the sustainability of it. You know, it's very difficult for people in that underground to make any money. You know, they don't make money from gigs. Nobody buys their records unless they make records that vinyl dads like buying. And so just on that level, it's the sustainability of it. I wish more people be into it. But also, I'd much rather people were listening to Nod, as on my T-shirt, than Ed Sheeran. It would do them good.
Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I had bad things happen when some fraudsters stole my bank details without me realising. They didn't look at my ATM, you know, over my shoulder, and I didn't go on any dodgy websites. I just got hacked. But in the process of trying to look for an Oyster card, because I would always use my Connect thing, I found a postcard that Alan Bennett sent me. I'd sent him my children's books. I used to harangue him, as Miranda Sawyer very well knows, and sent him all my work, because I knew where he lived, because he lived near me in Camden. And I found this lovely thing. And again, it's like I wanted a good story at the end of the show. And thank you very much for the book. It looks really interesting. I'll read it. Yeah, it didn't get that to me. But I found that and it was lovely and it cheered me up so much. It's probably 10 years old, that postcard, 12 years old. Fantastic. Yes.
Oh. What was on the front of it?
That's a really good question. It is a picture of a gate.
Oh, wow.
It's a picture of a gate in Derby. Wow. Next to a dry stone wall.
There you go.
Yeah, that sounds lovely.
Isn't it? And it's slightly open, the gate. Possibilities. So that's going to get framed on my wall.
Well, that's a lovely up way to end the show, which I'm going to ruin with a massive down. Because my closing time chatter is, it's a very quick one. When I used to study politics, it was considered to be absolutely dreadful that people were so apathetic and uninvolved. The biggest threat to British society was apathy towards politics. And what we need to do is get people re-engaged with politics because it would make things better. Now, everybody's engaged in politics. Look what a bloody mess it is. Everybody hates everybody. Common sense has been driven from the room and the country is destroying itself. My campaign is to make Britain apathetic again. MBAA on a baseball cap. Stop engaging with politics. It's not making you happy. It's not making things better. A lack of engagement in politics is an indication that society is going well. So I think step away from the keyboard. Step away. That's my prescription. Ooh. Anyway, that's the end of the show. Thank you to our special guest, Luke Turner. What are you up to next?
That's a good question. I'm going on tour again. I'll be doing this tour thing called Modern Ritual, which is me and various other people going around Britain doing readings and making music and stuff. So we're going to Hebden Bridge and LSO St Luke's for the Barbican.
Fantastic.
Rock and roll tour.
There you go. And thank you to Miranda Sawyer. What are you up to next?
Well, we've got a talk going on at the House of St. Barnabas about... You will like this, Andrew. Mm-hmm. It's about sex, gender and superheroes. It's essentially about, like, are our superhero films better now we've got Wonder Woman and Black Panther? The answer is yes. So that will be coming up. And I'm meant to be writing a book. It's going really badly. So I'm doing really active avoidance tactics. They're going really well.
Like appearing on podcasts. Yeah, okay, good one. So thanks to everybody for coming. Thanks as ever to Sean Pattenden and to producer Jack Claremans. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/channels/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We're going to play it with my choice of tune. Concert senior rave brothers Orbital are back with a new album called Monsters Exist, coming out in September. I am personally delighted about this. This is their brand new single from our album. This is called Tiny Foldable Cities. Have a listen, and we'll see you next week.